This is Book Radio. I'm Mark Strassman. Our guest today is David Thompson, the author of Beneath Mulholland, Thoughts on Hollywood and Its Ghosts. Welcome to Book Radio.
Thank you.
There are elements in this book that are essentially extensions of some of your other books. I thought maybe we'd touch on that a little bit. There's this very sad story of sort of not the last of the Selznicks, but probably the most depressing of them. Tell us what's involved in that story.
Well, I'll try and bring it down because it's a long story, but several years ago I did the biography of David Selznick, The Man Who Made Gone with the Wind. And when I first took that book on, I sat down with David's two sons, because they were being very helpful to me on the book, and we made a family tree so I could understand just everyone in the family. And there was this figure, Joan Selznick, who was their cousin. She was the daughter of Myron Selznick, who was David's brother. And Myron was, in his day, the great talent agent in town. And I said, well, where's Joan? And they said, oh, well, no one's seen her for 30 years. She's a recluse. She's an alcoholic. She went away. She lives down in Laguna Beach. She never answers letters. She doesn't know very much, but, you know, don't worry about her. So I sort of put her on one side because I had many people to interview who were much older than she was. She was maybe about 60 at that time.
I was going to say, by the way, when you're talking about how you wanted to interview the older people first.
Well, because they might die.
They might die.
Yeah.
And the parts of the story that they knew were the earlier parts of the
story.
Earlier
parts of the story, right. Absolutely. And I thought there'd be plenty of time to catch up
right.
with Joan. Well, one day, Jeffrey Selznick, one of the two sons, calls me and says, I've just been called by a friend who works in radio in Los Angeles, and there's a word coming out of Laguna Beach that someone has just died there who sounds like my cousin Joan. I'm going to go down and take a look. Would you want to come? So we met in Laguna Beach, and the house was already taped off, the yellow tape, because she had died under uncertain circumstances. She just died of natural causes, but she hadn't been out of the house in 20 years, and she was indeed a recluse. She was living in a tiny cottage on the cliff at Laguna Beach. And to all intents and purposes, she seemed like someone impoverished, not just without money, but without human contacts also. And we went into the house, and it was probably the most appalling place I've ever seen. The trash came up to the level of your thigh on the ground floor. But it turned out that this woman who had died that way owned not just the house in which she died and the house next door, but four ranches, some of them in Hawaii. She owned her father's old ski lodge up at Lake Arrowhead. She owned the land on which Neiman Marcus stands on Wilshire Boulevard.
Right.
And she owned 6.7% of the producer's share of a thing called Gone with the Wind. She was incredibly rich. And she had died in this appalling, lonely, impoverished way. Well, this was a story that I couldn't really tell in the book because it was a side issue, but I wrote it around the time I was there, and I kept the piece, and this seemed like a perfect place because she's a real true Hollywood ghost. She's like the sort of sad, unromantic reality of Norma Desmond in a way, because she was a Hollywood person and she had all this money. She was the only Selznick who still owned any of Gone with the Wind at the end. And she had no one to come and see her.
She could have been a contender, but instead she was out there.
Absolutely.
At the beach.
And really,
it was very much not Tara, at least you could
say. That's right. And a very, very sad story. And something that stayed with me, so I was glad to be able to publish it here.
If we could slide into Norma Desmond a little bit.
Yeah.
What's the main point you're trying to make about Hollywood's propensity to create ghosts of various types, and if it's not too much pinning you down, what are you meaning by a ghost throughout this book?
Well, I mean someone who has many of the attributes of life, but not all of them.
Right, the lifelike, you call
it. It's the lifelike. I think that the movies did something absolutely fascinating, but very dangerous for all of us. they made us aware of the lifelike. And once that happens, life means a little less. And I think the movies have always been an inducement and an encouragement to us to live more in fantasy. I think there's a lot that's very rich and creative in that. There's also things that are dangerous in it. And the ghosts, for me, are these people that we think we know, the people we've seen on the screen for 30, 50 years maybe, but we don't know them. We never really knew them as real people. They are the characters in films, and they are also these people a little bit like John Selznick, who were real, actual, but they led lives that are scarcely credible. I mean, if you were to tell people exactly what happened to John Selznick, they would say, it sounds like a movie. And it's that area of confusion that I think we all feel.
Yeah, let's try to, if we can, if it's not an oxymoron, focus on some of this confusion. And the creation of the lifelike and how it spills out off the screen. What the idea that kept occurring, the film that kept occurring to me, of course, was The Purple Rose of Cairo, in which the characters walk off the screen.
On and off the screen,
right.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about. But you do talk about President Reagan, who was, in some cases, in some ways, the prime example of this, since he had, well, why don't you say how Reagan as ghost, and now, of course, he with all respect to him, he is becoming...
Has become another kind of ghost. Yes.
How did that ghostliness, lifelikeness of his confusion of his characters with real history and with
Reagan,
and people's confusion of him as a...
Reagan, I think, was trained, was raised almost as an actor to say things that were from scripts. And he had an attitude to himself, to what he might be, that was derived largely from the movies in which he played sort of rugged, reliable, heroic, but not quite central people. And I think that he carried this over into what is, notionally at least, the most important real aspect of our lives, how we are actually governed, how we are led. And I think in many ways he was a very successful president because he was always determined that he was playing the part.
And in fact, he walked out of the screen the same way Jeff Daniels does in Purple Rose, confusing, of course, the actor with the characters and so on.
Yes.
But and then was accepted, was
totally,
was empowered by the American people,
totally,
in the real role of president.
Absolutely.
Thereby creating the reconstituting the presidency as essentially a
totally
filmic kind of concept.
That's right. And I mean, it's the moment at which, as I say, our most vital level of reality, our government, becomes like our movie. And it's with Reagan above all, I think, that you realize that question, what is the president? Answer, the president is the man who goes on television,
right,
and talks to us.
And the next level of that, Bill Clinton, who invites Hollywood into the White House to spend the night, and comes here to get his money to run his election, and Al Gore following him and so on, that Hollywood as a whole is sort of casting these people, is auditioning these people to cast them in the roles as president.
Yeah. Clinton, I think, is a lot more canny about it.
Sure.
I think that one of the wonderful and really frightening things about Reagan was Reagan never felt the threshold as he crossed over. It was absolutely painless there.
Right. Right.
But as you say, now Reagan has gone into another kind of
twilight
and a very, very tragic state. Because, you know, I mean, here's the other thing. He now no longer knows what to say. And really, I think one of the secrets to Reagan all through his years was he said what people told him to say. He said what he learned as the right thing to say. And you can imagine the burden for a man who now no longer knows what to say. It must be very great.
Another sort of variation of the same theme comes from the fact that some of the text in Beneath Mulholland focuses on people who are also lifelike, sort of from the other direction. In this very room, I interviewed Michael Murphy a few weeks ago, who's written a book called The Kingdom of Shiva's Irons, about this I have to think mythical, I think would probably be the right way to describe him, character who he uses as a vehicle to discuss various ideas about spirituality and reality. You, on the other hand, write about Perkins Cobb. Can you tell us a little about his history and who he is?
Well, Perkins Cobb is, on the face of it, a man who made one film. It's a film called My Sweet Dread. He was I hesitate to say important figure, but for the people who were inside in the late 60s and 70s, he was a known figure and an admired and revered figure. He worked on a lot of screenplays quietly, without credit, you understand,
right,
doctoring them.
Right.
And he made this one film, My Sweet Dread, which went almost instantly into cult status.
Very cult. I tried to get it over at Blockbuster this weekend. And
it's tough to
it was,
get.
I had to wait a long time.
That's real cult status,
right,
you know. And he vanished. He disappeared. And as far as we know, killed himself driving a car off a cliff in southern Utah, which is in fact where he came from originally. And he's become a sort of legendary figure, the kind of guy who made a film and then turned his back on the business because he said, I've made a film, I don't want to do another one, it's not worth making another film. And he was someone I had known a little bit and heard a bit about, and I wrote about him. Now I step back from that.
Right.
He is an entirely invented figure,
as you could tell
when you couldn't find
him. I couldn't find the tape over there.
But you know, we had some people who called the magazine after that piece appeared really quite upset that they couldn't find him.
Yes, yeah,
and I took that as a great tribute.
I wanted
them to believe in this man.
Okay. Now,
and of course, I only think I made him up. You know.
Right. It's hard to tell. There's sort of another type of approach that you take here with extensions of the stories that we already know about Tony Manero, Elvira Montana, and Jessica Rabbit. My favorite, I think.
Well, I did a book in 1985 called Suspects, which began life as a kind of dictionary of characters. And then as I was working on it, I discovered that these characters from film noir, mystery films, could all have met one another. And I turned it into a sort of novel. I got enormous pleasure out of doing it, and a lot of people enjoyed it. And I have put some more of those suspect-like characters into this book, too.
The computer people I talked to tell me that soon it will be possible to take, or maybe it was in your book, it's starting to blend together, agents of these virtual versions of these characters, the way Humphrey Bogart appears in
television commercials.
And can
be done.
Bring them together.
It can be done.
And
there's no
question. You'll have found your métier there, and you'll
I
be ready to start writing with Attila the Hun meets Florence Nightingale.
Well, I mean, for instance, I really hope that I will be able to do the screenplay of the first film to star James Dean and Marilyn Monroe. Well, I think we can agree.
This is Book File. I'm Mark Harrison.
Our guest today is
Rabbi David A. Cooper, author of God is a Bird.
The discussion of Jessica
Rabbit,
apparently,
a couple
of people. Well, I'm glad you like that because it's one of my favorites.
I hope I wasn't getting carried away. I just had the feeling that she was a metaphor for Hollywood and what was
and
you know, the eyes here.
Take full responsibility of our
personal roles. Well, while you're looking, I think that we can say that
just as easily be optimistic as
Rabbit is one of the
okay. Well, one way people can get some more information about all this is to read God is a Verb, Kabbalah, and the Practice of Mystic Judaism by Rabbi David A. Cooper, who's talked to us.
Clever commentary upon Los Angeles. I think the true sequel to Chinatown, actually.
Forget it, Roger. It's just
Toontown. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Wonderful film.
James Dean lives on.
Yes.
Becomes sort of a more energetic Warren Beatty, it seems.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can't get away from that sort of figure. This is a piece that was written for a magazine a long time ago. It was whenever James Dean would have been 50.
Right.
They wanted a piece that speculated on the notion what would have happened if he had survived that crash where we know or think he died.
Sort of along the level, what would have happened if President Kennedy had not been shot?
That's right, that kind of thing. So I speculated, and the magazine looked at the piece, and they came to the conclusion that too many people might think it was in bad taste.
How long ago was this?
This was about 1980, when, you know, taste was a real conception, right. You understand?
Right.
And so the piece did not get published, but I kept it, and I trusted that its time would come.
The level of taste would sink low
enough.
That's right.
And so that piece is in the book. And what I basically do is see Dean becoming more and more of a tyrant and more and more of a creative figure, someone who directs films, but he also becomes involved with the Kennedys, and he is present at the events now known as Chappaquiddick.
Or claims to have been.
Claims to have been, and he takes the fall.
Right.
He takes the blame, and that's how Edward Kennedy became president.
Right, and says, somewhat ironically, never let a man with a steel arm drive.
That's right. Because
that was very funny.
Because in the original crash, the one just outside Paso Robles, he did lose a hand.
Oh, in addition to dying?
Yes.
Yes, okay, I hadn't known that. Why don't we try to be serious for a second? Do filmmakers have moral and ethical responsibilities, do you think? And if so, what are they?
I think the only viable responsibilities you can expect a filmmaker to hold are to himself and to his own sense, or her own self, about what they want to do, what it is they're doing, whether what they're doing is reckless or dangerous. I mean, I don't think you can really invent and institute any kind of set of tests that you can apply. I think, this is my opinion, I thought JFK was a reckless, irresponsible film.
Because
I think it encouraged people not to take history seriously. And I think that we all should take history seriously.
You mean playing fast and loose with turning theories into practice?
I think so, too much. Now, I'm not saying that because he did that, that film should be banned. It's, in many ways, a very good film, very entertaining film. I personally would say to Oliver Stone, you should think hard about what you did. But I think in the end it's the individual filmmaker's responsibility. I think we're all living in slippery times. The ground is giving way beneath our feet.
Reciprocally, do audiences have any moral or ethical responsibilities in this film-going enterprise? Or is that a nonsensical question?
No, I don't think it is. I'll pick on something concrete, which I think is a very telling sign of our times. We have a rating system now that allows a film to be an NC-17. An NC-17 is a film where, flat out, there is stuff in the film that people under 17 should not see. Now, I think most of us over 17 would agree with the concept that such material exists and that there ought to be, or that there ought to be room for films that deal with it. No commercial film wants to be an NC-17 because it cuts the audience down so drastically. So we now have what is called the R rating, where basically we say there is stuff in this film that is unfit for children. However, if you want to take your child to the film and pay for your ticket and the child's ticket, we won't stop you. Now that seems to me to be flagrant, institutionalized irresponsibility to make a buck.
Right.
And it's something we ought to be ashamed of. I think we ought to say we mean it when we say there are some films here with material that children shouldn't see.
Okay. Tying in on whether children should or will be able to see things, could you say something about the impact on yourself and on in general of the proliferation of VCRs, DVD, and other technologies that make film and cable television, which constantly show the Turner classic movies and so on, so that films are becoming more ubiquitous, more available all the time?
It produces schizophrenia because anyone who studies or has taught or wants to analyze or wants to investigate film is given this wonderful tool, the VCR, and the availability of so many films, nearly every film in a way, on VCR, on tape. You know, once upon a time, not that long ago, lots of films you simply couldn't get. You couldn't see them. So it's a tremendous asset to be able to do that. But what is happening all the time is that the image is getting smaller. And the fundamental notion of movie as a huge image, much bigger than us, in this great, great dark where we are alone and vulnerable, that is receding. And young people today, I think, do not have the experience that you and I had when we were children of going to these movies and being in awe and fear of the sheer size of the thing. And I think that the longer that goes on, the more likely it is that the magic in film risks dying.
The biggest film out this week is, what is that bug film? Starship Troopers, with really big bugs being blown up by really good-looking people. Now, this does not have the subtle irony of I was misinformed about the waters in Casablanca. And to a certain extent, people our age are informed by that irony and subtlety and complexity in the same way, I suppose, that people who now consider it a peak aesthetic experience to go see Starship Troopers will consider the quips made by the soldiers as they march off to blow up the bugs.
They'll be the lines that are swapped around the classroom.
Right, and yeah. And the catchphrases and the lines around which people will form their sensibilities, their consciousness, and their lives. What kind of world is that going to be?
It's a very tough one to answer. I had a very formative experience last summer. I took my son, who was 7, to see Independence Day.
Right.
And he had been totally converted by that long promotional campaign they had for that film on television. He saw the ads, and he wanted to see that film. And they opened it in this remarkable way where it played for 24 hours solid. And we went to see a 7 a.m. screening. And I did not much like the film, but he loved it. And I had so much pleasure watching his pleasure. And I don't want to knock anyone's pleasure because it's formative. And it may well be that Independence Day and Starship Troopers, although Starship Troopers is an R, that's a film that one shouldn't take a
right.
kid to.
Right.
But it may well be that those movies are going to hold the place for kids today that movies like Red River maybe or whatever held
right.
when I was that age.
Right.
And I don't want to risk sneering
right.
at anyone's pleasure. But I have to say, and I think the tone of your question sort of implied this, that standards aren't improving.
Right,
you know?
Okay.
And we are, you know, to go back to a point you made, I think, or were implying, once upon a time, movies were photographic. They were about photographic records of real people doing certain things, dressed up and in a fictional atmosphere, but they had that sense of reality and of real light. They're becoming increasingly electronic as opposed to photographic.
Right.
In other words, they are being composed out of special effects.
Digital.
Things
right.
that never happened or could have happened.
Digital rather than analog, in a
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what's that going to mean for the
movie? I think it lets fantasy run rampant. And
it unhinges the image from any semblance of reality.
Any sense of reality. And I think in the end, that ends up saying reality doesn't matter that much. And I think that's, I mean, I was talking about the loss of history.
Right.
The loss of history, the loss of reality seems to me to be the groundwork for a fascistic state that I don't want to be a part of.
Glad to talk to you, David Thompson, Thomson, no
Thank
P.
Thank you, no P.
Author of Beneath Mulholland.
Yes.
Ghosts.
Thoughts on Hollywood.
Thoughts on Hollywood and its ghosts. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.